Let's see if he'll talk to us.
There's no way.
Ask him.
How convinced are we that he's guilty? What percentage convinced?
100%.
I'm about 70.
It is no accident that this tree trimmer was accused of rape in another county.
He'd have to be Mirandized. It's a death penalty state. There's nothing in it for him.
He is a narcissist. Might just do it to prove that he can. Definitely looks older than 12.
See, that's what I thought.
Okay. Thank you. So it's not just me.
Well, and these girls these days, and they're developing so early.
They sure are. Of course, Lisa was in junior high. Whoever picked her up might not have known that.
I'm sitting here racking my brain, trying to remember if I saw someone, but...
We believe he thought she was older than 12. She was friendly. Probably came up to him. He thought if they got together, it'd be consensual.
Well, 14 is the age of consent.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I guess George is kind of forward-thinking in that respect.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and co-creator and executive producer of The Case Of.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague.
Here we are at the season finale of the first season, and I believe there's going to be multiple seasons in years to come, of Mindhunter.
Mm-hmm. They commissioned season two before season one had even fully aired.
That was quick. I think the next season is going to be set in Atlanta, to be about the Atlanta child murders, which I don't know anything about. But
Well, John Douglas was an instrumental part of that prosecution. And yeah, he's got a great story to tell. I've heard him tell it a number of times. It's really fascinating.
Right, so here we are. Before we get into the actual episode, I wanted to talk about the opening credits. Sorry, I just have to.
Please do, Lisa. What can you share with us?
You know, when I was rewatching the show this morning, and I know Jim did too, I was noticing that I don't skip through these credits like I normally do. Mm. You know, there's a cold opening scene, and then it goes into the credits. And a lot of times on Netflix, you can skip the intro. And I wasn't. And part of it is it kind of settles you into the eeriness of it. Mm. But also, David Fincher is famous for his opening credits. Some of them have gotten awards, like
really?
Girl and the Dragon Tattoo. It's a big thing with him. So I was looking at the credits and going, why do I keep watching it? Well, first of all, the music is haunting. It's like this.
The music definitely is.
It's piano music. But then I'm watching it, and so you see a reel-to-reel
recorder,
which of course we don't use anymore. This cold machine that's being, you know, loaded with tape, and intercut with it at 4 frames a second are very graphic photos of corpses, you know. And it made me think of Fight Club, because that's a theme in Fight Club where Tyler Durden shows movies with a clip of pornography in them just to sort of throw people. Anyway, but so it's very chilling, and yet you can't stop watching it. And I think that he uses 25 photos of corpses in this intro, and it's just really an interesting, haunting way to start. And people have written very eloquently about this. So the credits are meant to shock this and to warn us that what you're going to see is going to contain violence against women. And isn't that true? In each instance of violence we've seen in Mindhunter, the victim has been a young woman. The crimes are motivated by the killer's distorted relationships with women in their lives and their sexual-related hang-ups. Essentially, the women shown in the credits could be any and all of the victims. For the killers on the show, women aren't individual human beings who deserve to live. Women are objects of scorn, violence, fascination, and sexual frustration, easily overpowered and easily disposable. The opening credit sequence is harrowing number of reminder of women's place in the imagination of some of the Mindhunter characters.
Mm.
So there you go.
I would go even stronger than that. I would say it depicts hatred and, you know, the enraged sort of misogynistic views. It's absolute contempt for women is evident in all these serial killers. The women in their lives, the significant women in their lives and others didn't do as they wanted them to or didn't behave in the way that they wished them to. So, you know, misogyny and violence against women and girls, you know, is across the whole of this series. And, you know, I think one of the things, we've said it before, that they do well, it's not too gratuitous or sensationalist in terms of the actual cases. It's not, I think they're, you know, they're very few scenes showing, you know, bodies. But this is all about violence against women and girls and hatred and contempt for women. I'd take it one step further because that's what it is. I'm naming it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So now we get into it. The last episode we left with Agent McSqueaky sending a tape, and we start this episode with mail delivery. But it's mail delivery from a very unwanted suitor to Holden's attention.
At this point, it's apparently the fourth or fifth card that Holden has been receiving, asking him to come back and play with his favorite 6'9", you know, 385-pound serial killer, Ed Kemper. And
not my idea of a fun play date.
No, well, not his either, and I think he just hangs them on the wall sort of as sort of trophies, I suppose. Yeah. But he kind of ignores them, and that'll come back to haunt him a little
does
later.
Does this happen? Do serial killers become obsessed with the people who either catch them or who...
Well, I wouldn't call it obsession. I think it's more internalized. I think because the rapport building process and the interview process is meant in some cases to actually build them up, to play to their ego. And so it's just furthering their own ego. They want the FBI. Remember, they're locked in prison for the rest of their lives. This is the only real interaction he has with the outside, any kind of, you know, sort of intellectual repartee that he's going to have is with these FBI agents. And they're also going to be responsible for him, quote, going down in history. And so it's that. I think it's very egotistical. And sure, there are plenty that, I mean, that agreed to talk to us because they want to be part of that. So to say that they would also try to continue it when we're sort of done with them, just, I think, normal.
Mm. The fact that, you know, when the agents are going and interacting, you know, you said it, Jim, I'll put it in a slightly different way. You know, what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about their favorite subject, which is me, myself, and I.
Yep.
And so that, you know...
And my victims.
And the victims, and bolsters it up. And then you've got, you know, the play date is kind of the right way of putting it, you know, people to play with. And some of these guys, of course, think that they are far superior, the serial killers. And let's not muddle the two groups. But, you know, the serial killers believe, some of them, that they're more superior and intellectually on a different plane. And so they are toying with them in a way, but this relationship sort of develops, and Kemper's almost acting like a, you know, a jealous lover, deprived of attention. I'd say a jealous and abusive lover who's deprived of attention, and that power and control dynamic is always being played out between them.
So Bill gets a phone call from law enforcement down in Georgia where they've just been advising, and the law enforcement there has not taken Bill's advice. They did administer a polygraph to their main suspect, and he passed the polygraph with flying colors.
Well, it was actually inconclusive. A polygraph is actually an interrogation tool, and what they hope is by polygraphing somebody, they'll be able to confront them with their results and then get them to confess. And that was a failed attempt in this case.
Right. So they had to let him go, I guess, because there was no physical evidence tying him to the crime. So they're asking for help. So Bill and Holden decide to go down there and talk to him. And the police are like, well, why would he talk to you? He's nothing, you know. And Holden says, well, he's a narcissist. He thinks he's beaten this polygraph. He's not going to be afraid to talk to me. And if we set the right scene, which they do,
right,
you know, he'll want to come in.
Right. And so this is a perfect example of how we stage an interview and an interrogation and how important it is to know the personality of the offender before you do this. And one of the first things he does is say, oh, this is his report. We need more. So add fake pages in there, you know, because what'll that do? It'll do two things. One, it'll tell him, oh, I'm important, which will help lower his defenses. And the other thing it'll do at the same time is, oh, wait a minute. They know a lot about me. Maybe it'll pucker them up a little bit too. So they want him sort of off balance at some point. And also setting the stage of this being a little girl and her majorette outfit, you know, was a little girl thing. And, you know, it was white and happy. And, you know, he has the cop go out and get a baton so that they could add that to the mix. And then he sees the rock, and he realizes the rock is the thing that he needs to put in there. And just like he did with the shoe for Brutos, he covered it up, and he covered up the rock. And then at some point, because of what he said, he lifted up the jacket and he exposed that rock.
So
and that was a real turning point.
Right. So they set the scene, and when we see the guy who comes in, the actor is Adam Zastro, who we actually cast on Criminal Minds just a couple of years ago. It was like his first, he'd been like an extra in a couple things, but this was like his first
thing. So you actually helped him.
Yeah,
that's
and
amazing.
I remember I taped
that's
him.
Great.
Yeah, he got this off of tape. He came in and I taped him and showed it to, I think it was Tanya directed it.
Oh, yeah.
It was the episode about being in a cult. And so he had this really eerie monologue, and I knew he would be just perfect. He's kind of creepy, but then he's kind of, especially in this episode, he's kind of dirty, sexy. I mean, you can see how a young girl would kind of think he was cool, like a hippie or long haired hippie. But anyway, so Adam
Zastro. I'm not so sure about that. I think that's completely
he was pretty
subjective.
Creepy. He did a great job in this.
He was good.
Yeah. Being creepy
role,
and making your skin
lanky, wiry, long hair. Yeah. Anyway, so he comes walking in and
very believable. I mean, I didn't at all think he was acting. He totally sold that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe because in my real life I just don't focus on the offenders as much. In this series, I'm sort of forced to. Mm. I'm really amazed at the acting. I really think they've all brought it. I mean, I've seen the tapes of these guys, the original offenders.
Right.
I've actually gone out and interviewed many, many offenders myself. And these guys just really pulled it off. I was very, very happy with that.
Yeah, the nice thing is they used a lot of not well-known actors, you know, and that's key, because if you have somebody who, you know, one of our producers warns us against this all the time of having an actor that really distracts from the scene because you've seen them in a million things or they're a name actor, you have to be, you know, really think about that before you put somebody in it. Anyway, so I just think this is such a great scene because you see them playing him, trying to get him closer and closer to a confession, and they ask him over and over. So you didn't talk to her. And just get him closer to admitting he saw her and that, they taught, you know, just leading him.
Right. And so we should talk about false confessions here, because what they're playing with is, sort of pushing somebody and giving them information and not just being passive in terms of what comes to them. And, you know, they are giving out a certain amount of information, and they are sort of asking him over and over and over again, but it really doesn't have a positive effect. And then Holden turns off the tape. And that should never have been done. Mm. You should not do that. I mean, the whole point of it is that law enforcement has to be held accountable. There's no question about it. And this is a criminal investigation. They're in the middle of it. This is not research. And even though he was saying some pretty nasty things, again, trying to build rapport, trying to take the judgment out of what happened and trying to actually, you know, think the way this offender must have thought in order to do these crimes, help him rationalize and project and minimize what he did. And so those are things that are difficult to put on tape, but those of us who work in this field have to do it. And so by putting it out there and by making it commonplace, you actually can help other cops to be able to do the same thing, because it's necessary to build rapport with these guys and to not be judgmental. So that's just really outrageous. And it's a crime. It should never be done. And I don't like that it was in there, but it was in there for dramatic purposes.
And I think to show that he learned the wrong lesson from the last
time
he was just, okay, fine. If this is going to get me in trouble, I'm going to turn off the tape. Have all the P-U-S-S-Y talk.
Right.
And,
But let me just tell you that, in fact, in the FBI, we did not record interrogations until very recent history. It's something I argued for many years ago. I remember talking to Director Mueller about it, you know, just why aren't we doing it? And he said, well, because we do 6,000 interviews a day. And you know, we just don't have the capacity to be able to store all that. And I'm like, well, I don't know if that's true. I mean, if Google and Facebook and Instagram can have that kind of storage capacity, why can't the FBI? And it's just a dollar and cents thing. So anyway, eventually they did relent, and now criminal interviews are recorded by the FBI, which is a great thing because it protects not only the case and the agents, but if somebody does give a false confession, the evidence is typically right there on the tape.
So, what did you think that that scene crossed the line to coercion?
I mean, turning off the tape, yeah, it opens yourself up to all sorts of things. And, you know, the rapport building, yes, it's very uncomfortable, but it's the subject at hand. It's all very uncomfortable when you're talking about little girls being raped and murdered.
Yes.
It's, you know, a subject that should make people feel very uncomfortable. But I think the tactics that are used, you know, to not be distracted by that in one sense, you know, that he says everyone has a shoe or a rock or something that makes them sweat, you know, really trying to get psychologically under the skin, you know, and trying to understand a perpetrator, and, you know, talks about guilt and creating a situation where the guilt overwhelms someone. I mean, the tools and tactics being used are the things that are also on display. And, you know, I think we're seeing Holden now starting to hone his craft, as yes. it were, and get into his flow.
Right. Yeah.
His FLOW. And, of course, that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, his partner included, albeit he still goes along
right.
with these things.
Yeah,
in
the local
same
cop
breath.
Obviously was very disturbed by it, and he called a break, and he said, "What the hell are you doing?" And they kind of justified it by saying, well, he stopped the tape. And anyway, not a good justification, actually a bad thing. I've definitely had cases in which cops have either delayed recording or stopped recording, covered up the right. fact that they actually provided all the information to the defendant, and that defendant was then later convicted and then exonerated. And it's just, it's a horrible situation, and I would definitely advise against it in any case, because it's a crime to do that, cover it up. So anyway, they actually get him to confess.
Right.
And they do it by not being judgmental, by sort of luring him in. I would not say that this was coercive. But what I would say is that it was definitely, you know, playing with the boundaries, and turning the tape off, as Laura said, is the thing that crossed the line. But what they said and did actually wasn't that bad. And when he revealed the rock by picking up her majorette jacket, you know, and the defendant was just fixated on it. He couldn't look away. He realized, oh my God, they got me. Mm-hmm. And so he started confessing, and that everything turned. It's right. like, okay, we know you did it. No problem. And they go through the details, and they get it out, and they get out this confession, and it's a very effective tool, and we've used it many times successfully.
So Lisa, the victim in this case, she was 12 years old, and I believe the age of consent in Georgia is 14. So Holden sort of zones in on that, and actually zoning in on that, but using things he's learnt from Kemper and using exactly the same language that Kemper would use to try and zone in to the psychology of this individual, is an interesting tactic that we see, you know, being displayed in this scene. And of course, he gets the result that he wants, because he does confess to it. But there's details that are given that it's clear that he is the perpetrator. He did commit this crime. And of course, Holden then sees that as, you know, a real victory. And then it goes into the next scene, I believe, where he's bragging about it.
Yeah, so they all the cops go out, you know, afterwards to decompress, and he starts, you know, really holding court
and
bragging.
Yeah, he's drinking a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, Bill's just like, ikshnay on the agging bray, but he just doesn't, and you can see, and I want to ask you about this, he's getting confident, which I guess is good, but he's also getting this complex of, I know more than anyone, and...
Of arrogance.
And I mean, is that a...
Are you asking me to opine on whether or not John Douglas has a level of arrogance, or is that what they're depicting in this show?
I mean, how do you avoid that?
You can take the question as you see fit, Jim C.
All right, well, I think that they are certainly depicting that, and I think with his interactions professionally, and I think with his interactions with his girlfriend, that you're seeing that come out, and she calls him out on it.
Yeah.
She's his sort of anchor, And, you know, eventually that will come to a head. But, you know, you combat it in the real world by realizing the severity of your responsibility. And, you know, speaking out of turn like that, which eventually gets quoted in a newspaper, mm-hmm. and then gets back to Kemper, of all people.
Snowball, yeah.
Yeah, it obviously can hurt what they're doing, and it obviously can hurt cases. So I think it was a sort of slap on the wrist and back to reality.
So, after he, you know, is all bragging and getting all this attention in the bar, he goes home and comes back to Earth with Deb, because she completely questions him. Like, you went in there predisposed that he was guilty, and so everything you did, you know, led you to that, to the desired conclusion. I mean, did you notice that at all in this?
Well, actually, that is a very effective interrogation technique. In fact, if you don't have yourself convinced of it, it's impossible to convince the person across from you that you do feel he's guilty. But that's a turning point in the interrogation. In other words, you know, you ask questions, you know, you look at the evidence, you go in there, you know, with the knowledge. And if the person is not guilty, then you will typically see different behaviors when you confront somebody. For example, somebody who is innocent will typically continue to deny and get in your face. And those things, as you don't listen to them, they'll get more forceful and more frequent. Whereas people who are guilty, they sort of plateau out and kind of fade away their denials. And so that's something behaviorally that tells you something. And then, you know, you try different things, you test different things. If that guy were not the offender, why would that rock affect him at all?
Yeah.
So it's a test. And so you set the stage to see how he reacts to it. And it will either confirm or refute what you believe. Now, that said, once somebody confesses, you still have to drill down. You have to get all the details from them, things that weren't publicized, see how they used different tools and things and where they left things, so that you can verify whether this guy did, in fact, commit the crime. So, okay. As a result of this confession, they make a big deal out of the fact that he is now going to be subject to a death penalty prosecution.
Right. Somebody at the bar, one of the cops at the bar, talks to the press,
right.
And this whole case kind of comes out to the public, which is key. And you would never want that, right? You would never want the public to kind of know all of the techniques that you're using,
no.
or bring attention to yourself. That seems very antithetical
in fact,
to the FBI.
You know, I think we do a good job sort of depicting it in Criminal Minds. When profilers interact with law enforcement on a case, they basically do what they do and they fade away into the night. They don't hold press conferences and tell people mm-hmm. what they did and brag about accomplishments. And because of that, many people think there haven't been a lot of successes with profiling. They don't realize there have been thousands and thousands of cases. It's just we don't do PR. We help law enforcement. We don't take the credit for it. And so this was a big faux pas. This was something that, you know, really shouldn't have been done. And it had bad consequences.
Right. And when Dr. Wendy is like, oh, hell no, you know, this is going to be very bad, because as you started to say, it's a death penalty case, and she wants to try to convince the prosecutor not to go for that, because she's
right.
afraid that it, why is she afraid of that?
Well, because if they're using the research to convict other people, and then they're going to kill those people, who's going to want to help?
So I mean, why are they going to want to talk to the unit? Or
is, yeah.
counterintuitive.
Right. So this actually brings up a point that was near and dear to me, because I believe I was the only profiler that was against the death penalty. Everybody else thought it was great when it happened. People would celebrate that one of their serial killers or serial rapists or child abductors got the death penalty. And I'm against it on principle. And so because I know that the death penalty is actually applied greater towards minorities and poor people and people that don't have the wherewithal to fight and have great teams of attorneys. So because it's not fairly applied, I don't believe it should be applied at all. And just the fact that you could have multiple people, hundreds of people on death row, exonerated later by DNA, I mean, it just speaks volumes about why we should not have the death penalty.
I am asking you to consider life without the possibility of parole.
I'm an elected official. Here in Georgia, death is the will of the people. And if you don't want to be involved publicly, then maybe you should keep yourselves out of the news.
Wendy and Holden go down to Atlanta, and Holden's like, follow my lead. And she's like, go fuck yourself. And she's like, I'm going to talk to this lady prosecutor. And it's great. This is a great scene between two really strong actresses. They're in this room, and there's this she's prosecutor. Am I saying the right thing?
Yeah, she's the DA.
The DA. And this actress who is Rhoda Griffiths. Fantastic. She's like a lioness in a Chanel suit. I mean, she's fierce, but she is fantastically dressed. And she's just like, honey, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Sorry. Right?
The great state of Georgia makes a statement. Honey, we don't put people to death. They put themselves to death.
Right, right.
You know,
we don't kill criminals. They kill themselves.
Right.
I was wondering if you caught this. She says, when I talk to a jury, I ask them who watches cop shows, and right there, you know, if you got a smart jury or not. I'm not sure if that meant. I'm not sure if that means that they're smart or not.
They watch, are they smart? If they don't watch, are they smart? I don't know. She left that open.
I'm just enjoying both of your southern accents. I think they're great.
Francie's gonna be like, oh my gosh. Anyway.
Yeah, but you know what? I think Francie might have been the model for that prosecutor, actually. Yeah, I'm sure Francie had a few conversations like that. Sorry, Francie, in the course of her prosecution duties when she was in the state of Georgia.
She's very pro-death penalty, isn't she?
She is.
We'll come back to that conversation another time.
One thing this prosecutor does say, Laura, which made me think of you, is she says, you know, when I'm prosecuting this case, I'm letting them know about the victims. I'm saying this is not like Rockford Files or Barney Miller or Hawaii Five-O that they focus on law enforcement. I'm letting you know that this is not TV and there are real victims here. And she really kind of hammers that home, and that's part of her strategy. They get nowhere with
great.
Her.
Yeah, they get absolutely nowhere with her. And Holden basically says to Dr. Wendy, "What did you expect? I mean, come on." So. Frustrated, they go back.
Right.
And I think this is the scene where Holden finds his girlfriend on the front porch and she's drinking wine.
Yeah, and he profiles her.
He profiles the breakup.
Oh, man.
And I thought, I loved this scene because...
You did.
Absolutely, because it's just sort of how it is when you're a profiler. I mean, you can't be ignorant anymore. I mean, you see people's behavior and you have to understand it better than the average bear. You know, so, I mean, he didn't want to see it, and so he was trying to get past it with her, but when she said, well, what do you think? He just reads her, and he reads her absolutely correctly, and all the evidence was there. She didn't get up to greet him. She knew he would be coming by. She only had one glass of wine. The bottle's half empty now. Generous portion of white wine.
Generous pouring.
She would not go out to dinner with him. She wanted to build up courage. Why would she need to build up courage?
Because she's going to break up with him. You have to be a profiler to see that she was going to break up with him. I mean, I don't know. I don't think so, but...
Well, no, but it's just the point that Jim's making that, you know, you behaviorally are attuned and you analyze, you know, everything. It's not just you go to work and that's your job and therefore, you know, what's before you in terms of crime or violence is what you're profiling. It's you read every situation.
Yeah. Right. And it's sort of an albatross hanging around your neck.
Yeah, it's a blessing or a curse question.
It's difficult to be in relationships with a profiler, I'm sure. Mm. As it must be to be in relationships with a hostage negotiator or somebody who's a card shark and, you know, can read behavior because they're used to doing that around a card table. The thing is that, as we talked about earlier, that people wear masks. Mm. And unfortunately for those people, profilers see through masks. Mm. And it's a difficult life when you have that sort of X-ray vision and the person that you're with or you want to be with is being dishonest or is being negative in some way. Many times you pick up those nuances before they even are aware they're giving them to you.
It was just an interesting dialogue between them, between Holden and Debbie, where, you know, he's saying that she was sweet and curious when they first met, and, you know, he wants to be admired by her. And he says, you know, why won't you just be my girlfriend? And she says, what do you mean, for me to shut up and adore you? Mm. And he turns around and says, yes, you can try it. And I just think it's an interesting kind of play, because he likes her because she's curious and interested in the world, and she's studying, you know, sociology and is interested in violent behavior, and she is expanding his horizon. But now he's starting to get some results at what he's doing. Mm. He's now gone into Brachiosaurus mode, and, you know, he wants to be put on this pedestal and adored by her, and he doesn't want her opinion. He wants her just to be admiring him on the sidelines, which wasn't the deal when they got together. And I think there's an interesting switch in the temperature of their relationship and the dynamic
right.
in it.
And I think that's interesting, because that's something that profilers get too in relationships. You know, stop being a profiler, just be my other half. You know, don't, you know, constantly put me through all those questions and all your analysis. And I think that's basically what he was trying to say. I mean, sometimes women will say this and men will say this, you know, I just need to be heard and I don't need to be analyzed or I don't need to be challenged right now. I'm going through too much. Mm. But as you said, Laura, he was actually in bragging mode and he wanted adulation rather than just, you know, a listening ear.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the question raises, you know, is he a charismatic person? Is it, you know, who is he as an individual as mm-hmm. well? Where are his levels of narcissism, Jim? And where's his ego placed in all of this? You know, he is under the microscope too. Mm-hmm. And I think these are just some of the subtle nods. And, you know, there's a power and control dynamic starting to eke in there. You know, mm-hmm. if he just wants to be adored by her, well, that's not who she is. She's someone who's studying, who's broadening her horizon, who's a person in her own right. And so I think there's just some interesting play. And I just felt, you know, potentially Debbie should have been used far more throughout the season one. But I'm hoping she's going to be in season two and we're going to hear much more from her, because I think she's a great character.
I definitely warmed up to this character. One thing I wanted... Oh, some of our listeners have wondered if you think that Holden is a sociopath, just because they are put off by the way that he is with people. But I don't know. You have an opinion.
Sociopath would be somebody who's committing crimes.
Or a psychopath. And he has some of the same tendencies of the people he's studying.
I think he's mimicking them, but why would anybody think that he has no human empathy? Does he not care for other people? Does he not show mm-hmm. that he does? Does he not take on the responsibility of protecting those kids from the tickler principle? You know, I think he does actually care about people, so I think that is a little off.
I believe there's certainly some traits coming through around, you know, his ego and narcissism and, you know, the play. He does want to be the best in his field, and you hear his kind of inner dialogue of the only mistake he made was not listening to himself and... You know, I think the character development, we're going to see more, but I think there's certainly some times where, you know, he is arrogant and he's
off script.
There's no
question, arrogant and egotistical, but sociopathic? Mm-hmm. I think that's very extreme. When you take it home, just because you see traces of things doesn't mean the rest of it is there. In other words, in order to actually diagnose someone as a psychopath or a sociopath, I mean, there's a whole diagnostic criterion that you'd have to meet. And, you know, a lot of times we see little shades of it here and there, but it doesn't mean that somebody has actually got a mental disorder. And, you know, but people do have egos. And one of the things about profilers is they had to fight and compete to get into that unit. So typically that's a process where they have to toot their own horn and they have to be successful in order to get in there. So I think you're going to see a number of profilers who have that as an issue.
Yeah, and I mean, most people do have traits of narcissism anyway. So when armchair psychologists, if you will, diagnose someone from a distance, you know, I hear it a lot bandied around, oh, they're a narcissist, or they're a narcissist, or a sociopath and psychopath. I think it can be quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. But there are traits of narcissism in him. It doesn't necessarily make you a narcissist, but I think the character development is going to be interesting across the next season, because there's certainly some things, like I said, that I was uncomfortable with, particularly his dynamic within the relationship with Debbie and where that was going. And some of the things that he was sort of saying to her and wanting her to be different to what she was when they first met each other. And now he feels, you know, he's in flow of, he knows these things that nobody else knows. You know, is that true? Well, we see that get taken further with the whole Kemper mm-hmm. scene and the fragility of right. his understanding. Actually, it goes to another level when he realizes perhaps he read some things wrong and his own mm-hmm. life is potentially in danger.
What's this behavioral profiling you're touting?
Well, it's a way to determine a criminal's psychology based on crime scenes and personal characteristics.
I love that. What's my psychology?
I can't really tell you that.
You can't, or you won't.
It's shop talk, Ed.
My favorite.
So we're in the home stretch here on this episode. We get back. Holden's got a message that Kemper has tried to kill himself and that he's been named the proxy on...
The medical proxy, right. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty amazing, huh?
Surprising.
Yeah, yes. Well, Kemper bases it on something that was leaked out in that article that... You know, we're buddies, we're friends. He said, are we friends?
Mm-hmm. All right, so before we get to the final scene, just to catch us up a little bit, Holden finds out that Kemper tried to kill himself, and then the Office of Professional Responsibility gets the tape from McSqueaky, and they're all busted, and they're questioned again by Internal Affairs. And as we've said, Holden is just, he doesn't care. He's completely insubordinate and is like, I know better than you, and he basically is daring them to...
Come after
fire him. He feels like he's solved all these cases, and so, or they've solved
but
all these cases.
Yeah. One thing that you did see was that he was very honest. He took responsibility for everything that happened. He even protected his
Bill.
Bill and Squeaky Clean Guy. Mm-hmm. And so he took it on his old shoulders, and he said, basically, you don't understand what I do. I have to do this. We were forced into a position where we had to lie to you, and. You know, I'm willing to stand by what I did. And then he walks away. Yeah, he could have handled it better. If he did that in the real world to the OPR, they would come at him with their guns blazing.
Right. All right. So now we get to the final scene where we go to Sacramento, where Eddie Kemper is being, is in recovery from attempting suicide. Right. And
it's kind of amazing the way they set it up, you know, so he's chained to this bed and...
He barely fits on the bed.
Right. His feet are like hanging over. And, you know, he's having this conversation and he says he's read this article and he said, you were quoted as saying we were friends. And he said, well, Holden says, well, you know, it's in the context of the work we're doing together. We're colleagues, you know. And he said, our work together, you know, that's really great. I love that. And... He starts explaining to him what profiling is, and Kemper's just like in awe. He's like, oh, I love this stuff. This is exactly... Because what we found is a lot of these serial killers have their cop buffs. I mean, they want to be looked up to by cops. They want to be seen as collegial with cops. And so this is what was motivating him in this scene. And, you know, he was like a kid, you know.
Huh, I didn't read it that way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I felt like he was just so elated by the fact that, you know, he read that Ford had made these statements and, you know, so there was things that were good about those statements and then he gets to the bad things about it.
I was going to say, how did you read it, Lisa?
I think he's mad as hell that he's been ignored and he's been biding his time, and when he's looking at Holden, I got that he's devouring him with his eyes with both love and hate, and he's got it planned out on what he's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I read it, he was like a jealous lover, you know, deprived of his attention and desperate to get his attention.
And feeling used.
And that power and control dynamic kicking in.
Yeah,
but he was very surprised that Holden showed up. I think he didn't know that that was absolutely going to happen. And I think there was also a little bit of cat and mouse going on here. You know, he wants to lull him into a feeling of, you know, complacency, and then
he's helpless.
He does this amazing thing where he just puts his feet on the ground. Boom.
Terrifying.
Yeah. And it's then he stands up.
Move. It's the simplest thing.
Yeah, but it's very threatening. Effect. And then as the you know, nurses at the station go away, you know, just he takes that time to like race out to the end of his chain and block off Holden's escape.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he made a comment, interesting how in the emergency rooms here, you know, there's no way to call for security. And then he says, I could kill you right now very easily. You know, I mean, the threat, the subtlety.
So soft.
The softness of it, the reality of it. And you could see Holden looking up to this monster. And I know, I mean, I've been in the room with these monsters, you know, these physical monsters, big guys who could kill you, and they have nothing to lose. And you don't have your weapon with you.
Right.
So it's a difficult situation to be in. Of course, he's in a really difficult situation because he's cornered, and now he knows that Kemper is pissed off, and he's coming at him. And it's a really, really good scene. I mean, just very well executed.
I defy anyone to watch that scene and not have an increase in their heart rate.
When you see a big guy like that suddenly move quickly, because until now he's been kind of just like a lumbering heavy.
Right.
When he gets up and moves so quickly, it is very jarring. And what does he say about the women he killed? You know, he could never get anyone to stay with him. And by killing them, they become his
spirit wives.
And they're with him to this day. And he said, I could kill you now. And then you'd be with me forever.
Yeah,
it's really scary.
It's very high on the creepometer.
Right, and then he comes closer and closer and closer. And it's really, you're like, what's going to happen here? And you can see Holden sweating. And he's looking up and he's sweating. He's like, what did I get myself into here? He's looking around. Nobody's there to help him. Of course, I would be looking for any instrument to whack this guy over the head with just to make noise and get the hell out of there. But he was just in panic mode. And then what does Kemper do? He comes up and hugs him. I mean, just totally engulfs him. And this freaks out Ford. I mean, he just flips out and he's able to wrangle his way out and run down the hall. And, you know, he's in the middle of a panic attack and he collapses. And you know, he's saying, I'm dying, I'm dying. I don't know. He can't answer questions. And he just thinks he's dying. It was a terrible thing. And I'm brought back to the reality of John Douglas in the course of doing these interviews. He was traveling a great deal, and it didn't happen in the hospital, but at some point he collapsed. And I believe he was found 3 days later in a motel room when he didn't show up back at Quantico. And he almost lost his life. I mean, he and I share that. Like, we've had some near-death experiences or, you know, should-have-been death experiences. And you know, it was a terrible turning point in his career because he realized that all this stuff was just weighing on him, this terrible, terrible stuff. And I thought they depicted that in a very, very good way here. Just, I mean, I was so scared for him when he was in that room and Kemper went at him and hugged him. I thought, this is it. He's over. So I thought they did a great job.
Yeah, I love when he was lying on the floor, all of the voices of his past are just coming back, all the warnings, all of the, you know, that was great.
Showed the vulnerability, and that's, you know, the truth of the matter, isn't it? The human being part going into that situation, it's incredibly risky, but that vulnerability that comes to the fore, that Kemper could have actually done whatever he chose to, the bear hug, which is kind of even creepier and more sinister, and just, yeah, this panic attack that happens, complete fear that sets in, and he is gripped by the fear, and that's what the panic attack is all about.
Yeah.
So we close out of the scene with Led Zeppelin.
The final scene is going back to BTK. Yeah. He's outside of his house and he's throwing his bind, torture, and kill sketches into the fire, burning them. And what I believe that is saying is he's now committed to actually acting on these fantasies. He's burning all the evidence of it because he's about to start doing it in the real world.
Yeah, it's In the Light by Led Zeppelin.
So that's what it goes. That's what it ends with.
Yeah, it's that when he enters the hospital and then when he leaves with his panic attack, it's Led Zeppelin.
And there's still one more scene with BTK.
So there you go.
Wow. I mean, and then we go out, and I believe, and I felt this throughout watching the series, that this is going to come back season after season after season because there's so much good material. And I think they're doing an amazing job with it. And I think, you know, everybody involved, all the actors, all the producers, the directors, everybody did an amazing job putting out such a great piece of work. Because not only is it entertainment and enthralling and captivating, it's actually teaching some really good stuff. And I think we've attempted over the years to do the same thing with Criminal Minds. And I think this show is going to do that in a very real way. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, there's no shortage of stories to tell, I'm sure.
Stories within stories and subplots and the characters and, of course, the cases that go with it. So it does so many things all in one show. And as you talk about, Lisa, you know, the cinematography, the blouses, the wallpaper, you're educating me certainly on some of the things that, you know.
Useless information, but anyway.
No,
because it all goes into making a good show.
We don't see those things the way you do, and that's great to hear it.
I'm looking at the content and the language and the cases and the kind of the interactions and the genesis of the behavioral profiling unit, and that's what's so great when we're having this discussion. You know, we're pointing out different things. It's an education, so thank you.
Yeah, and do you have any recommendations? I do. So I would recommend two movies. One is called I, Tonya, and I thought it was so well written and executed. It was a historical event that I was alive for, and I thought I knew, but I didn't. And what was most amazing about this film is at the end, when you see this film and all the different actors, all the crazy things that went on, they actually show the real people being interviewed. And some of the things that I thought were absolutely made up, they were not made up.
Really?
They were real. So
oh,
that was amazing.
God.
And then the other movie that I really loved was Molly's Game. Surprisingly, I had never heard anything about it, but it was Idris Elba and Jessica Chastain. And Idris played his role very understated, but he had one incredible monologue that I thought was great. And Jessica, oh my God, there was so much intricate math and maneuvering and behavior, and you know, I think it was masterfully written and by Aaron Sorkin, and it was masterfully executed by the actor. So I would definitely recommend Molly's Game.
Yeah, I have to see that because I love Idris Elba. Please Google Idris Elba with cupcakes and a puppy, and you'll be very happy because that's a great picture of him with the cupcakes and a puppy. I do have a recommendation. Actually, Jim, you turned me onto this series called Black Mirror.
Mm.
The most recent season is fantastic.
Really?
Some of it is extremely disturbing and violent. Oh. So, you know, caution there. But I really enjoyed it, so I recommend that.
Yeah, well, I watched a couple of seasons of it, and I can't wait till the next season of Ozark comes out. It's a show by Chris Mundy, and when I started watching it, I reached out to Chris, and I told him it was amazing, and he said, that's great, and he said he was very busy writing season two, so hopefully we'll get to see that soon. I thought it was really well done.
Okay, cool.
Just going to remind people again to watch Peaky Blinders season 4, and I'm going to say to Jim, please persevere with it. Put the subtitles on because it's really worth it. And the same if you haven't seen it, Lisa, you know, just put the subtitles on. It's incredible. The storyline, the plots, the acting, the cinematography, the music.
I agree on the cinematography. That one episode I did watch, I thought it was amazingly shot, but I literally I had to stop and replay dozens of times I couldn't understand what they were saying, but I didn't know I could just turn on the subtitles.
Yeah.
You can. I mean, even I struggle with it. But, you know, Lisa, you see some wallpaper that you can tell me about, and clothes.
Blouses and everything.
So many things that I'd be missing without your insight.
Okay, so. All right. I'll do my best.
All right, well, guys. Signing off on our series about Mindhunter, an amazing Netflix original series by John Douglas, Charlize Theron, and David Fincher. Please watch it and enjoy. And for now, signing off on Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family, and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.